Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to the weekly Critic podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by the excellent writer and researcher, James McSweeney. James, the first article of yours that I saw while I've been at the magazine was a very interesting article called British Energy Planning, a Horror Story, which it's an excellent article, but also it's an excellent title. Now, can you explain why British energy planning is a horror story and not kind of a family-friendly drama?
Well, thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here. So I guess on first sight, it is a cuddly family-friendly film. It just turns out to be one of those parody versions where, you know, the cuddly talking animal or toy turns out to be a homicidal maniac. So if you look at a lot of projections you'll see on Spectator, they'll have UK energy capacity, which is the energy we generate every year. And you'll see a big upward trend as we add all these renewables to the grid. And I was on board with this. I thought this was cool. But the problem happens when you start discounting things that aren't always available. So I noticed this a couple of years ago because I was doing some other tasks, and I kind of noticed that if you take those out, the actual generation we can have on demand, that is what they call dispatchable generation, was trending downwards. It's gone down like over 20% in 10 years, and I thought that was a bit concerning. So I then looked up the demand projections. And I found out, this was 2021, the demand used to exceed supply like that year. So in other words, from then on out, if the wind doesn't blow at a time of peak demand, the lights cut out, basically, which is a concern. And it's about to get worse as well. So we're still shutting down conventional generation. Drax has just said yesterday that they're not going to have their coal stations available next winter, which is a bit alarming because we used coal to prevent a blackout as recently as March. And by 2027, Drax predicts we'll have about 85% what we need. So we'll basically be rolling the dice every winter from there on, which is a wee bit concerning.
What would you say is the realistic worst-case scenario?
I keep changing my mind on this. Every winter, I'm crossing my fingers that things don't go wrong. Another part of me thinks that the sooner things do go wrong, the sooner we can start correcting ourselves. Because, you know, I thought we started getting these blackout warnings a couple of winters ago, and every year the situation becomes more precarious. And I thought this would shake people awake. And it turns out I massively overestimated public servants. So I was aware of this problem for like a year before I decided to write about it, because it just didn't make any sense to me that I could, as a sort of researcher who's dealing with something else, I could notice this and have no one else out there like sounding the alarms in like official positions. I thought I must have had something wrong. And then when it really hit me is I cornered a junior minister in the energy department, and I told him about it. And he sort of like laughed awkwardly and said, "Ha, classic civil service." And then changed the subject very quickly. And at that point, I sort of realized that actually no one is taking anything particularly seriously in government at all. In terms of the worst case scenario is that we tick on like this for another 5 years, avoiding blackouts before they hit. And at that point, our energy system is so warped that it will take us like years to return to anything reliable and anything cheap. Because that's the other story here. So there are two problems, really. There's the problem whereby we are rolling the dice every winter and we don't know if the power's going to stay on. And then the other problem, which is that energy is becoming increasingly expensive because renewables, contrary to popular myth, are very, very expensive. So that would be my worst case scenario, I think.
So let's wind back in time a little bit. How did we get to this extremely precarious point. What led up to these the kind of accumulation of risk?
So the last Labour government passed the Climate Change Act, which gave us a statutory obligation to reach net zero by 2050. We were the first country on Earth to do this. It was very exciting. We were pleased to be world leaders. And it was also very convenient because it didn't seem to affect anyone at the time. So from that point on, our energy planners had to basically run a statutory obligation to plan as if they could hit this target. Another thing that Act did was it created the Climate Change Commission, which is a nominally independent public body, which advises the government on a lot of its modeling. And it actually has a big strategic advantage here because, like, ministers jump between departments all the time, civil servants jump between departments all the time, there's no like long-term planning within actual government, so they rely heavily on these models when they're making their plans. And unfortunately, because it's called the Climate Change Commission, it naturally attracts kind of activists. We relied a lot on their modeling, which turned out to be bogus. In fact, they tried to resist revealing the basis of their modeling. And a couple of years ago, it turned out they had assumed that windless days would drop by a factor of 20. That was the basis of our energy planning, that we just wouldn't have windless days at some point in the future, so wind would be fine. So they were giving the government bogus modeling. The government was very excited that it was a green energy superpower, because politicians like to attach the superpower to things. I saw a policy paper recently which said that Britain's about to be a recycling superpower as well, so there's that. And so we just kept ticking along. Civil servants increasingly were just kind of lying to ministers, and it became increasingly easy to lie to ministers because it's not, when you introduce the civil service pay cap, civil servants are the only way to really get a meaningful pay rise and promotion was to move between departments. So your civil service manager moves between departments every 1.5 years. So from that point onwards, basically everyone's just passing the buck in both the civil service and in politics. And politicians were effectively incentivizing civil service to lie to them, and then making even grander promises based on those lies. And then the lies would have to be exaggerated. So if you read Energy Department policy papers, read two years apart, and it'll be like the first has completely forgotten everything that was written in the last one. Like what the earlier one said we needed, that will just be completely forgotten. We'll have a completely different figure. It gets quite dramatic. So like, if you look at like 2012, thereabouts, we said we need like 30 gigawatts of new gas generation. And then a few years later, it's downgraded to 14. And then it was downgraded to like zero. So you've got that problem, basically, proliferating. And then there's the other problem, which is when you introduce government incentives, you basically, you're not only in terms of industrial strategy, like subsidies, you're not only incentivizing civil servants to lie to you, but you're also incentivizing businesses to lie to you. So governments will be assured by businesses, like giving them a huge amount of subsidy to build wind farms, new cables, hydrogen pipelines, etc. It's an excellent, excellent idea. Government will be like, well, we're a business-friendly government, so we'll just do what the industry experts are telling us to do. And the industry experts are just lying. A lot of them, some of them don't know they're lying, as in a lot of the CEOs, they like the idea of subsidy, they'll push for it, but they don't really understand the technicalities. But one thing I've done a couple of times when I've been to lobbying events in Westminster is you pull aside one of the engineers, and once they realize you're not a particularly important person, and that you kind of know what you're talking about, they'll come clean with you. I had this sort of a wind event recently, and the engineer in question was just like, yeah, this is an absolute nightmare. We're going to have brownouts in the next few years. This is very expensive. This is my job, basically. Because engineers, something about an engineer's mind is because it's susceptible to immediate feedback when they make mistakes. They find it harder to bullshit. Whereas if you have a degree in classics from Oxford, say, like the head of UK Energy, you have basically been rewarded for chatting nonsense like your entire life, for like implying that you know more than you do for eloquence. And so a lot of these people seem to swell the ranks of lobbyists and quangos like CCC and NG UK. NG UK is more like a trade body, but you get the picture. And obviously ministries. So we have an energy department run by lawyers and classicists. And the same goes for a lot of these industrial types. And the only people who really know how bad things are is, but none of these people can really be bothered to get their honest opinion because, they kind of look down on them a bit.
Right. It sounds like Britain is a dishonesty superpower. That could be our new brand.
So several factors. One is the Act incentivizing civil servants to lie and incentivizing people to make bad commitments. The other one is the quangor that was created by that Act, which is the CCC, the Climate Change Commission, which is staffed by activists and gives the government bad modeling and who have been caught lying. And then the third one is businesses being incentivized to lie by subsequent subsidies. And the fourth one is that there are good politicians and people in institutions, but a large portion of them just have no technical training whatsoever and just love the limelight and have gone through their life basically talking themselves up and don't really have any other skills. So I guess those four factors really combine to create a perfect storm where we're all in danger and energy prices are really high.
So you've used one note of optimism in this podcast, which is, I think you implied that there is at least the theoretical possibility of correction. What could be done in an ideal world to improve the situation?
So if engineers staged a violent coup, what would they do? It's kind of too late to do a lot of the things people would like to do. Keeping all of our stations ticking over that are still there with whatever subsidy we require would be a necessity. And then we don't have the options other European countries had when they kind of realized the mistake. So, when Germany was cut off from Russian gas, they reactivated a load of their old mothballed coal stations. And a lot of other European countries did the same sort of thing. For what I assume were cinematic reasons, blew off our coal stations when we turned them off, which basically rules out that option. But you can build coal stations relatively quickly. So that would be an option. It's obviously an ugly option, but like it's less ugly than like a full scale blackout in midwinter would kill tens of thousands of people. So it's less ugly than that option. So you'd move to backing up the capacity you have, just keeping it ticking over, building as much generation as quickly as possible, like dirty generation. And then for the long term, if you were still interested in trying to get to net zero, you could, if you completely change the planning system, you could get there. At least you could turn the energy network kind of net zero by 2050. But that would require basically building a huge amount of nuclear power plants. It's been done before. The French, when they had their nuclear drive in the 1970s, when they became scared about fluctuating gas prices, they built 56 nuclear reactors. They installed 56 nuclear reactors in like 15 years. We've installed one in that time, and it's not even active. And a large amount of that is just like planning rules are insane. So if we wanted to, in this beautiful alternative scenario where we're under the dictatorship of engineers who are sensible, and they don't have to worry about popular unrest from the shires or kind of gangs of NIMBYs with pitchforks, then yeah, that would be what you do. But I can't really see in the current context of Britain, British politics, where NIMBYs are so immensely powerful, how you could rectify the situation particularly quickly. So, I mean, you could create special planning orders. Like, I guess the government has the ability to use old closed down sites and build toll stations on them to reduce like short-term risk. But in terms of the long-term transition objective, that would be very, very difficult to do in British politics, I think.
Let's say you're talking to an open-minded environmentalist, someone who is very concerned about climate change, but obviously potentially concerned about them or their grandmother freezing to death. How would you persuade them that this is, you know, this energy crisis rather than the climate crisis is something that has to be focused on rather than monomaniacally pursuing just stop oil to the fullest extent?
Right. I mean, to take the cardboard cutout, like, just stop oil enthusiasts, there's not much reasoning. Because if you did just stop oil and gas, most of the world's population would die of hunger within a couple of years, because we use gas to make fertilizer, and half the world's population requires fertilizer to survive, and then most of the other half requires diesel fuel for both transport and tractors, harvesters, etc., to produce crops. So, you know, people like that who you explain that to and still think it's a good idea are just basically nuts, and there's no reasoning with them. But a more kind of like middling person, like your average, I guess, like young lefty, I think you can make that point to them. And in my experience, it does actually cut through a bit. So once you make that point, you have to kind of move to what's like practical. And what is practical is, other than just like cutting back on coal in the medium term, which actually does a lot of the heavy lifting for you, because coal is so much more polluting than gas. What does make sense in the long term is nuclear. And I mentioned a lot of planning problems. They are going to persist, but small modular reactors are an interesting phenomenon. They could, on paper, with special planning orders, be rolled out at a local level, and that would save you having to worry about cable. I don't think we'd be able to hit net zero anytime soon, but if you rolled those out, you would at least be making progress towards it. So the most logical solution is going for modern gas. This is once you get past the, you know, concern about avoiding immediate blackouts. But in terms of the medium to long term, you have a modern combined cycle gas plants, which are very efficient and so burn a lot less fuel for their output. And then you transition autos onto like small modular reactors and whatever nuclear technology comes along. And you make this argument to people. I've tried it out, actually, because I have protesters around my office a lot. And, you know, about 50% of them are susceptible to these kind of arguments. They never hear them because they never make it onto the news or anything. And then about 50% of them are just kind of like shouty and don't really care. But I don't think they're particularly representative of your average concerned voter.
I think we have a really disingenuous attitude towards hardcore environmentalists. And I mean, we as a kind of media and political culture, where I think the general perception is that their beliefs are right and they just have flawed tactics. Whereas to me, if their beliefs were right, I could completely understand them blocking a road. Whereas it's their beliefs where, if they're actually established, would have catastrophically horrendous consequences for countless people across the globe, not just in Britain, in terms of poverty and resources. So I don't understand this kind of condescension and coddling of the ideology, while we kind of vaguely wag our fingers towards their paint splashing antics.
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong. If I believe if we didn't move off oil and gas in the next 2 years, the world would end, I would have like a moral obligation to do a lot more than wave placards around. Like, I could understand that level of radicalism. If I believed A, that, and B, that, you know, being radical would help, which it doesn't, then yeah, I would be, you know, well, very brave enough. I'd be like, I don't know. I don't want to get in trouble for for encouraging violence or anything like that, but I could come up with some pretty nasty schemes to try and save the world for sure, and I would be morally justified. The thing is that they're not correct, because we need hydrocarbons, and we will for the foreseeable future, because we need them for food, we need them for heating most of the world. And yeah, the fact that we tolerate these people who are advocating basically just mass murder, it is fascinating. I don't understand why we do it. Well, I think I do understand why we do it, but if you can imagine a right-wing group which advocated such destructive outcomes taking to the streets, I mean, the police would just beat the snot out of them, really. I mean, these people would struggle to get jobs if they were found to have any relation to said groups. Their leaders would probably get arrested. They would be treated, yeah, they would be treated as a lot of right-wing radical groups have been in this country, whereby their members are fired from any position they have in government. They don't, their leaders get arrested under the Public Order Act, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting that we have that blind spot. I think it's because, and I've written about it, I think it's because a lot of them are just come across really nice. A lot of them are just like dithery old grannies who like knitting. A lot of, the younger ones are a bit more annoying, but they're kind of hippies, and everyone has like a soft spot for hippies because of, I don't know, like vague cultural memory of the 60s and early 70s. And so we kind of want to go easy on them. But it's really not an excuse to do the amount of damage that they do to other people's lives. And I think we should really, if we want them to improve themselves, we should really be meaner to them. We should treat them as mean as we would, as meanly as we treat anyone else. Because if they don't get that feedback, they will continue to act like idiots, basically.
What would you say to someone who's a little bit more technologically minded and is very optimistic that in the longer term, renewable energy is going to become much more efficient and much cheaper, and has the kind of attitude that if we can just carry on for the next few years, keeping the lights on, we're going to enter this kind of full luxury communism paradise where the whole world can be powered from the sun. I mean, is there any glimmer of truth within this ideological haystack?
Like, with enough time, who can say? But all I can say now is we're out by a factor of several thousand at the moment. It's not just that wind energy is very expensive, and it is very expensive. It's the need to back it up. Wind energy needs 100% backup, or nearing 100% backup, because sometimes it goes down to like 1% of installed capacity. So because the wind drops, we know this. Solar is constrained by a kind of well-known phenomenon. And so we need to back up the grid 100%. And you either do that with generators like nuclear, and if you do it with nuclear, then the question is, why are you building twice as much as you need when you could just have nuclear in the first place, because that's net zero? If you're doing it with gas, then there are loads of terrible cost implications for that, and also you're using gas. And if you do it with batteries, then you really, really get into trouble, because batteries are exceedingly expensive, and the costs are going to go up because we have a global shortage of lithium. We have about, like, identified reserves of lithium are about 20% what we would need for the first like 8 to 10 years of transition. There just isn't enough of it. Well, there will be enough of it in the earth, but in terms of not in identified reserves, which would mean we'd have to up our extraction rates by like 175%, I saw in one calculation. Sorry, 175 times I saw in one calculation. So it's not practical. It's very expensive. It's going to become more expensive. I looked at Labour's plans for a net zero grid by 2030 recently, and I estimated that the battery backup you need would be at least 32 terawatt hours, which came to, I think, about 230 £1,000 a household, it was over 300% of GDP. And those batteries would deteriorate and you'd have to replace them. And that doesn't take into account land costs, and there would be substantial land costs. It doesn't take into account cable costs, which should be a couple of thousand extra pounds. It's so unrealistic that I can't really, I just can't emphasize it enough. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen within our current planning rule constraints, but even if they were completely done away with it, it won't happen. It's too expensive. It would cripple us. It would cost three times our GDP and make energy so expensive that economic activity would just become impossible. It would reduce carbon emissions, though, so there's that. One thing, just because I have people listening to the podcast who know about these kind of things, we'll bring it up. Like, the government at the moment thinks green hydrogen is a great idea. And the reason they think green hydrogen is a great idea is because BP and Shell have told them it is, because they think they can make money out of it. But green hydrogen is actually a terrible idea. So the idea is, it's like, it sounds magical, which makes it really appealing to politicians, but it's like utopian. The politicians like to oscillate between utopian and dystopian futures. They can't really do middle ground, but like, it sounds really exciting. You use electricity from wind to convert water into hydrogen that you can burn to heat houses and run industry and stuff, or to power electricity generators. And the idea is, when you have excess wind, you'd use it to create this hydrogen, and that could be your backup. Well, the big problem with that is about 70% of the energy gets lost in the process. So you have to times the cost of green energy, which is already substantial, by 3.3. And that's before you account for like borrowing costs, installation costs and stuff. So, I mean, it makes like it would make £150 a megawatt hour wind like £500 a megawatt hour, which is 10 times pre-crisis norms. It's completely unviable. And on top of that, you'd have to build way more wind farms than we're planning to, because in order to have enough backup, you just need to have a massive surplus of wind. And then on top of that, it's the least dense gas in the universe, so it would escape and cause fires. There's an interesting study on the Blitz in London, actually, which found that a very sizable portion of the damage done by German bombings was because we had hydrogen blended into our gas back then, and it would escape, and it would cause mass fires, basically, which is why one of the main reasons we stopped using hydrogen in our gas in the 60s. So, yeah, bad ideas versus bad ideas.
I guess the only, not quite optimistic, but hopeful perspective on energy as a horror story is, generally at the end of a horror story, there is at least one final girl who escapes. So hopefully, with enough dedication and ingenuity, some of us are going to make that alive. That was an energy horror story. James McSweeney, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.